Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Queer Voices of the South podcast on the New Books Network. I'm John Marzalek, your host for today's podcast. I'll be interviewing Richard Harold about his book, My Buddha is Pink, Buddhism from a LGBTQI Perspective, published by the Sumero Press. Although today's podcast doesn't focus on the Queer South per se, it continues what I suppose I can call a mini-series within our podcast of my interviewing authors of books with themes on the intersection of queer identity and religious or spiritual identities. This is something important for many queer people, but especially for queer Southerners, like the ones I interviewed for my own book, who grew up in families and communities intertwined with their churches, often churches that rejected their identities as queer people. Many of our listeners, like the queer Southerners I interviewed, had negative rejecting experiences with their childhood religions and found alternative paths, religions, or spiritualities when they reached adulthood. Others are still searching. I think today's episode will offer yet another example of an alternative path for numerous queer Southerners, whether they are interested in learning more about Buddhism or simply curious about learning more about how its philosophy can help you live a life that brings more happiness. My Buddha is Pink is a collection of essays designed to help LGBTQI practitioners follow the Buddha's path without getting lost in dogma. As with other major religions of the world, there are portions of Buddhism that have persisted through the years that can come off as homophobic at worst, or at the minimum, restrictive toward the community. My Buddha is Pink seeks to slice through the dogma and hone in on Buddhism's basics to guide the solo practitioner on a skillful course toward a more fulfilling life. Moreover, it is a fun and lighthearted look at being a happy and healthy modern queer Buddhist in an environment where homophobia remains an issue. Richard Harold, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm excited that you're here today. I wondered if you could begin by telling our listeners about yourself.
Well, I certainly did not grow up in a Buddhist tradition. It is something that came into my life much, much later, and probably in a situation of, you know, intense emotional crisis and in pain in which I was trying to find something that I could latch on to in a more concrete way than perhaps the Catholic upbringing that I come from. And I found Buddhism to be so much more satisfying and also something that I could use on a day-to-day basis in living my life and striving to become a better human being. Probably began, I'm going to say around 2000, 2001 was when I became interested in Buddhism. And the book, as you say, it's a collection of essays, but they come from a blog that I used to keep because I thought that would be a good avenue to work on my practice. I didn't grow up in rural South. I grew up in rural Michigan. So my access to Buddhist teachers and to other Buddhists was very limited. So I used a personal practice in developing it and writing about it as I was going through it to help me develop the right habits, right focus, the right frame of mind to grow my practice.
Yeah, and I think having been to rural Michigan myself, I think there are so many similarities between rural Michigan and the rural South, especially in terms of access to things like Buddhism.
And with the predominant, not to necessarily disparage, you know, other religions and monotheism in particular, but it tends to be a very regimented and growing up with a queer identity, it certainly became exclusionary. And that was something that created tremendous conflict in me throughout my life. And Buddhism provided for me a much easier way to not only come to know and respect and love myself, but also to respect others.
Yeah, yeah. How did you end up turning these essays from a blog into a book? You know, what drew you to going a step further and actually publishing a book?
Well, writing the blog, I came into contact with other Buddhist writers who were frequent readers of my own blog, and we would communicate with each other from time to time. We even did article trades where someone would come up with a topic, and then we would write something. I would write an article that would be published on somebody else's blog, and that way we expanded our reach to other people and found out about us. So now you know what, as I started saying that, forgive me, I kind of lost track of what your question was.
That's okay. I was just curious about the whole process of, you know, you.
Oh, yes. Okay. Mind is a funny thing, right? You know, the monkey mind.
It is a funny thing. Sometimes... I was going to say the monkey mind you talk. We'll talk about that later in the podcast. Yeah.
So the idea to turn these essays then into books or a book came from one of these other bloggers. They said, hey, you know, why don't you, you can write a book. You can put these all together and write a book. And I thought, you know, yes, I could. And so, in fact, the publisher at Sumero Press, I got a referral from another Buddhist writer and who is also a Buddhist scholar. And he connected me with this publisher. And so I said, hey, this is what I got. Are you interested in doing it? And he said, sure, let's go. So I compiled the essays, rewrote some of them so that they worked together more effectively in the book form. And also, you know, some of my experiences and points of view over the time, you know, change a little bit. And so they needed to be updated to reflect my own personal growth. You know, something that I wrote from way back when I started the blog, which was also called My Buddha is Pink. I grew and became a different person. And so some of those things I don't necessarily consider the same way now as I did then.
Sure, sure. One of the things I really enjoyed about your book was how I learned so much in reading your book, because you explained things that I imagine could be really complicated in a way that I could really understand. And you also brought this humor in. There were places in the book where you almost had this campy tone, you know, to what you were saying to the queer listener or the queer reader in that case. And just wondered, you know, what made you decide to bring the humor in like you did?
Well, as I began to read more Buddhist texts and talk to monks and other practitioners, it became very apparent that Buddhism is like many other religions that come from backgrounds that are centuries old. And so they're all built on these ancient texts and the way people talked, you know, 2,500 years ago is a lot different than the way we talk now. And, you and even the concept of being gay was viewed very differently thousands of years ago. So there was important teachings I recognized within these texts, but man, sometimes the way they were presented with all these spirits and all kinds of, you know, mumbo jumbo kind of stuff. Yeah. And I wanted to distill it down to, you know, hey, how do I apply this today? In fact, one of my early teachers, it was kind of an open house ceremony for the Buddha's birthday in May. And he was speaking to the group. And, you know, one of his phrases that he often would say when new people would come to the Dhammasala, he would say things like, you know, hey, no, don't worry. We don't sacrifice goats here. You know, just kind of lighten things up to take the mystery. So much religion and theology gets cloaked in this mystery that, frankly, in my opinion, is very unnecessary.
And I like the way you said that, because that's really what I think I was trying to say that I got out of your book, was that you took so much of the mystery out of it and explained so many of these different concepts in a way that I think the average person like myself, who doesn't know much about Buddhism, could really understand. I think it's a real strength of your book.
Oh, thank you. And that was exactly what I was trying to achieve, especially when, you know, people get caught up and they think about, oh, well, what is all this rebirth stuff? And, you know, what is, you know, karma or kama, you know, what does all that mean? And blah, 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 blah. And it's kind of like, hey, do you want to be a good person? Here's how you do it.
Right. And that leads me to the next question that you cover early in the book. And I'll just kind of throw the question out at you. And that's, if I want to become a Buddhist, does that mean I need to become a vegetarian, believe in past lives, and give up sex?
Sorry, I'm not laughing at you. I'm just laughing in your general direction.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
Now, that is a very common, you know, reaction. And as I explain in the book, I mean, even the Buddha was not a vegetarian. You know, it's a tradition of monks. So, well, the tradition of monks, it was created so that the Buddhist teachings could be preserved and so that they could devote their attention to developing their own awareness in their achievement to nibbana. They relied on lay people for their sustenance. So even, you know, in the 20th century, 21st century, one of the dhammasalas that I would go to, and a dhammasala is a place where it's a setting. It's not like a church. It's more of like a monastery where you can go to be educated in the Buddhist teachings, etc. So all the worldly things, monks are not supposed to touch money, and so things like that needed to be done for them. There was a reliance on the lay community to support the monks because the monks were developing the teachings. So the idea of that, they brought them food. So a monk ate whatever somebody put in their bowl. So, if somebody put meat in there, well, then, you know, that was a gift to them. So, you know, they would eat it. So the idea of becoming a vegetarian, I'm pretty sure, comes from the notion that you're not supposed to kill anything. You're not supposed to kill any sentient beings. But the people like to have things black and white. And Buddhism is a little more complex in that there are subtle shades of gray. And it isn't so much the fact that you killed an animal so that you could eat. It is the intention behind why you did it. You know, what are you trying to accomplish? And I mentioned it in an area of the book. A person who hunts animals to put food on their family's table, the karmic consequences of killing animals for them is going to be very different from the trophy hunter who goes to whatever foreign land, spends thousands and thousands of dollars just so that they can kill an animal for their own selfish desire.
To put a head on a wall. Yeah, right. It's terrible. Yeah. And, you know, this really gets into, there's so many questions come out of this. It really, you talk quite a bit about the difference between somebody being a monk and someone being a layperson, that somebody doesn't have to, someone who's drawn to Buddhism doesn't have to think that they have to become a monk to follow the Buddhist philosophy.
Right. That was something that I encountered, that there were a lot of Buddhist writers who seemed to expect lay people to follow the monastic code, particularly when it came to sex. And the monastic code is just that. It's designed for monks, which monks are supposed to abstain from all forms of sex. But that's not to be applied to lay people. But there were a lot of commentators throughout history who seemed to imply they would create these restrictions that, you know, sex was only for procreation, you know, which is not any different from very fundamental Christian points of view.
What we hear here, that's right.
Yeah. So it was the intention of the Buddhist teachings were being lost because of the voice, the ego of the person who was, you know, presenting it. Like any religion, Buddhism has the potential for someone to use the teachings for their own personal gain and benefit and power. Mm. We've seen that in the Buddhist community in terms of sex scandals, just as we have seen in the Christian community.
I really enjoyed the chapter on coming out. And I wondered if you could talk about how coming out can be related to Buddhism, or how Buddhism can help somebody in the coming out process.
Well, I wrote it, when you think back on the time when you did come out to others, just before coming out, there was a lot of anxiety, a lot of trepidation for many of us. For some people, it was, you know, hey, people knew I was gay as soon as I stepped out of the womb. There was no hiding it.
Yeah,
you know?
That's funny.
So for some people, it was a matter of dealing with in a more confrontational, but in a more upfront way, how people reacted to them. For others, it was a little more difficult. And so at that moment of coming out, there was a sense, at least for me, of relief and a sense of release. It was like I had just cast away these heavy bonds and weights that had been I'd been metaphorically dragging around all my life. And I finally realized that, hey, I don't have to live my life this way. I do not have to let the outside world be the entity that defines who I am. I can do that myself. So the whole concept of coming out is very liberating. And what I found with Buddhism was the same feeling of liberation, which I think maybe someone who converts, let's say, to a monotheistic belief, there is a moment of elation and in the experience of converting or whatever, of giving yourself into whatever theology that person is joining. But it's still an outside source. It is still an outside environment that is, again, controlling who you are and how you are perceived. But with Buddhism, just as in with coming out, it is a more inward expression and liberating in finding that I don't have to feel the way I feel, not because there's some puppet in the sky or whatever that is going to save me. I can save myself. And are you familiar with the anime film Evangelion?
No, I think you may have referenced that in the book, right?
Now, at the time I wrote the book, I didn't know about Evangelion, but
recently, I'm mixing it up with something else.
Yeah. Evangelion at this part, it's an anime series from like the 90s. But anyway, long story short, at the end, the main character, Shinji, learns that because he's had a miserable life, he believes his father doesn't love him. His mother died. So he just goes through life trying to please people. And he finally realizes that he can do things for himself. And then his reality, he is not subordinate to his reality. He can shape his own reality. And this really ties into the Buddhist notion of what is anatta. And that's this notion of no self, which is one of those things that people know, there is no self. Well, that's not exactly what no self means. What it means is there's no permanent self. We have a self, but it's always changing and adapting to whatever experiences we have in our life. And if we take control, or more control, I should say, because we can't control everything. There are other people in the world. But the more control we exert over what we do and how we react, the more influence it has on our immediate surroundings and our immediate reality. And that is very empowering, very, very vivid realization that, you know, I can, you know, if I think life sucks, I can do something about it. I'm not helpless.
You know, I thought it was fascinating in this whole line of thought how you talked about how coming out can be a transformative process, like you were saying, how, you know, yourself is changing, new reality and so on. And you talked about how there's a tendency to unconsciously move towards conformity.
And
after people come out, that they'll find themselves in the gay community or the queer community, and they'll find themselves conforming again to dress codes or certain ways people act. I wonder if you could talk some more about that. I think that's a great part of your book.
Right. Yes. Our gay liberation becomes a gay limitation.
That's a good way to say it. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It is true. You know, hey, you know, I come out and now I'm free to be me. But what am I? You know, am I a leather daddy? You know, am I the boy next door? You know, am I a drag queen? Do I wear Angora sweaters or do I wear polo shirts? You know, do I have to change what fashions I wear? You know, because we still have this desire that we want to fit in, and that's. A unique part, I think, part problem, pitfall with being gay, because when we were in the closet, when we were growing up, we didn't feel a part of things. We felt separated. Maybe we didn't know why we were feeling that way. But, you know, over time, we began to put two and two together and begin to realize that, wow, I am different. And that difference became a liability. We didn't like it necessarily. Some of us were stronger and we embraced that difference, and which is great. But yeah, we come out and then we have to, it's like, okay, I'm tired of pretending I'm part of this group. Oh, but now I'm going to be this group, you know, and I'm going to experiment with this or that, which I, in and of itself, I'm not saying is bad, but it's all accessory and hasn't really anything to do with who I am or who you are. As a person, hey, it's okay to accessorize your life. There's no problem with that. Everybody has their own little things they like to do, and that's perfectly fine. But when we confuse that with who am I as a person, you know, and how I react to other people, you know, going back to the notion of just be a good human being, you know, you don't have to wear a certain, you know, fashion. You don't have to behave a certain way to do that. Anybody can do that, regardless of what accessories you may be donning. It is a very common pitfall. And, you know, I fell into that pitfall for a while as well, as I mentioned, you know, in the book. And Buddhism opened my eyes to, okay, it's all right for me to like certain activities, but that's not who I am. There's more to who I am and more to my growth than these proclivities one may have.
Yeah, and it's interesting because there's so many, you know, what you're talking about is so similar to humanistic psychology, you know, and the focus of trying to self-actualize and become your real self versus becoming what you think others expect you to be. You know, that's a totally different conversation, but I find that fascinating. And, you know, the humanistic psychologists, I suppose, would talk about how not doing that can lead to depression and anxiety and so on. What does Buddhism say about that? What happens if somebody gets stuck in this trap of conformity?
Well, it goes back to the Four Noble Truths, which essentially is, you know, if your life sucks, you are doing something to make it suck. And So it comes back to how do you perceive what is going on? And are you looking for what it is you can do on your own without relying? And I'm not saying you don't become totally unreliant on others, but you're doing something for yourself as opposed to appease or please others. Mm-hmm. And that is, it's difficult, it's challenging, and it can be scary because the initial reaction, I think, for many people is, I don't want to isolate myself from people. You know, I like having friends. I like socializing. Yeah. You know, I like going to, you know, I like to go dancing. I like to go to the gay pride parade. I like to date people. I like to have sex. I like, you know, to have cocktails with friends. But all of those things are not me. And they're, you know, things that you can enjoy. And they're also things that, if I'm not paying attention to what's going on, I can start, I might do something that hurts somebody's feelings. I might do something that gets in the way of somebody else's pursuit of happiness. And that's how I make karma. And that's the realization of, okay, if something is blowing up in my face, you know, instead of blaming everybody else for blowing up in my face, can I sit down and think about somewhere along the line I did something? And that's not meaning I'm entirely to blame for everything, but somehow I played a role in this, and I need to know what that role is, so I don't do it again.
You know, I don't know if I'm applying this in the right place, but it really stuck with me. There was towards the end of your book, you quote a great metaphor that I guess another Buddhist writer had used about a musical instrument, that if the string is too tight or the string is too loose, it's obviously not going to play a note. It's not going to play the right note, or it's not going to sound right. And I wondered if this applied to what you're talking about with all these different things, that trying to find a balance between individually trying to find a balance for what's going to lead you to a, I don't know what the expression would be, right life, or how would you say that?
Yeah, well, the teaching, it's actually one of the Buddhist teachings that you were talking about.
Okay.
And that was the idea, is it kind of reflects back on what we know about the Buddha, because he tried at first, I mean, he was born into enormous wealth. He was a prince. So his every whim was catered to. You know, he wanted women, they brought him women. He wanted food, he did, lots of food, everything. And then he decided to go the other extreme, and that's when he became a hermit. And, you know, there are Buddhist images of a very emaciated Buddha, because he did, according to the stories, you know, potentially nearly starve himself to death. And then he realized that it's a striking the right balance in the middle. And that was another beautiful thing that I really liked about Buddhism, because of with Christianity, at least you have the 10 commandments. You have the 5 precepts in Buddhism, and the way they are structured is that they're more of encouragements as opposed to absolutes.
Okay.
So because of the idea, finding the middle ground of, you know, if you like wine, then, you know, understanding that, yes, having wine with your meal, you know, that's a perfectly fine thing. But when you overindulge, that's when you start making mistakes. You start harming people. You say things that hurt other people's feelings. You start to damage your body. You know, so it's kind of finding that balance. You don't need to completely abstain, but, you know, finding that balance. Same with any other substance. I mean, very much around the country now, most places you can use cannabis. It's you know, readily available, but that's another substance that can easily turn into something of overuse. So finding the right balance, like a finely tuned guitar, so that
it's
creating, you know, your life is creating beautiful music. It's soothing, and when something unexpected happens, even when something really tragic happens, you don't get rolled over by it. You can accept it, and it doesn't mean you won't get sad. It's fine. If you get sad, you get sad. You get angry, you get angry, but you don't let the emotion overwhelm you. You keep yourself centered, knowing that this is just the moment. Right now, it's not going to be like this forever.
You have the great chapter about sex, and you know, so many people who, I mean, I would venture to say maybe the majority, I'm not sure, but of queer people in the United States have, you know, heard messages from their church that it's you know, it's a sin to be gay, or it's a sin to have an alternative gender identity, and you know, you really frame this differently based on what your understanding of Buddhism is. But then at the same time, you say that there still are quite a few, I guess, Buddhist scholars who still really kind of come along with what some of these fundamentalist religions say, including supporting reparative therapy in Thailand. I think you even said at some point in your book.
Yes.
So I just wondered about all that. Yeah.
Yeah, as I said earlier, Buddhism is subject to the same prejudices that all humans are subject to, because the keepers of the faith are humans, and the wile of humanity is often, you know, what's in it for me? And all religious teachers run the potential, and Buddhists are no exception, of becoming charismatic leaders, in which people look up to them and think they can do no wrong, and then, you know, that can very much, I can turn you into a freak, and can turn you into a malicious freak, and you can get caught up in the grandeur of being such a, you know, well recognized and established scholar or monk or whatever teacher, and then you start doing things that are selfish and self-absorbed, and you hurt people. It happens in Buddhism just like it happens in other religions, which is why over time I got my core belief, core teachings from others. But then I stopped affiliating myself with sanghas, because Buddhism really is an individual journey.
Can you tell the listeners what a sangha is?
Yes, the sangha is the community of monks.
Okay.
Thanks. And so for monks, you know, they intentionally isolate themselves from the way of the world so that they can focus on the teachings and hopefully achieve enlightenment. For lay people, I mean, if you want to become enlightened, you might want to become a monastic and go that route, because there's very many distractions. But at the same time, I guess that's what I kind of say in my book, in my belief, you know, you can be a Buddhist and you don't have to have enlightenment as your ultimate goal. You know, just be a good person and, you know, try not to screw up somebody else's, you know, life just because you want something. Because the bottom line is almost every disappointment we experience in life is because we had unrealistic expectations. It's our expectations that disappoint us. And often we think we're doing the right thing, but, you know, maybe I'm trying to be friendly with this person, you know, not because I think they're a nice person, but maybe it's because I want to sleep with them, or maybe it's maybe it's because they can get me a job. And, you know, we're very good at lying to ourselves.
Part of the human nature, huh?
Yes. And what I liked about Buddhism was that it helped me, very much like you were talking about with the self-actualization and psychology, it helped me understand this thing called ego within myself. Right. I did not have to rely on prayer to an outside entity to guide me. It's everything I need to know is inside me already. I just need to find it and listen to it.
You know, I'm putting two different things you said at different parts of your book, but that they both kind of struck me together. One was you said that Buddhism is about, of course, it involves thinking, but you said Buddhism is more about acting than thinking. And then later in the book, you said that, I'm quoting here, Buddhism in North America tends to attract intellectual types, and intellectual types tend to overthink just about everything. And I read that and thought you were speaking to me, like, directly. And I thought there are so many of us like that. And so I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about, you know, those two things I just read.
Yeah, it does come down to action for the most part. And the way we think, thought is considered a form of action, because before, and so when I'm thinking of, when I'm speaking of thought, I'm keeping that separate from intellectualizing, which is a different endeavor, at least in my mind. Let me try and see if I can. The idea is that it's our thoughts, words, and deeds that create consequences. And every act, every deed begins with a thought.
Okay.
So that's where, you know, keeping the idea of, you know, asking ourselves, very much like how the Buddha taught his son Rahula when Rahula was like 7, 8 years old. You know, hey, once in a while, stop and think about what you're about to do. Think about what are the consequences. You know, would somebody be hurt? Is it going to benefit anybody? And then how is it going to impact you? We do so many things without even thinking of the consequences. We say things. Right. They just, boom, they come out. Well, I say what I mean all the time. Oh, that must be why you have no friends. So it really taking the time to think about our actions and the potential consequences. What the scholars tend to do is look at, well, what does this, how do you translate this from the Pali Canon? And, you know, who wrote this and when was it written? And, you know, what is Nibbana? What is, you know, the various stages of enlightenment? What is jhana? You know, all these very esoteric things, which interestingly, more and more scholars are beginning to realize that all that stuff was created after the Buddha was dead, and he may not ever have even talked about it. So
I remember you saying that in the book. Yeah, in fact, am I right in saying that I think you listed something called four right effects, and I think you said that those are the only things that can be really, only thing that can be truly attributed to Buddha? Did I get that right?
The Four Noble Truths, actually.
Four Noble Truths. I'm mixing things up. I'll mix up the list. Yeah,
you were, you were confusing it with the four right efforts.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That's funny.
A lot of numbers, you know.
A lot of numbers, yeah. I was going to say there, In fact, I wrote down, you talk about the metaphor of the three-legged stool, the let's see, 8 noble truths, I think, 5 hindrances to it's a whole list of things. And,
right. And the noble eightfold path.
Yeah. But then you also say, and I'm quoting here, you say, it's your movie. It wasn't written for you. You write it as you go along.
Yes.
I really like that line. That was a great line.
Yeah. One of my favorite teachings from the Buddha is he's talking to this monk who isolated himself in a forest away from everybody. And the Buddha was kind of chastising him, saying, you think this is how you do it? You know, you just go off in the woods and you go off by yourself. You know, there's more to it, you know, than that. And I'm sorry, my brain just twisted down another road here that I'm losing the focus of where I was going. But the idea that say that again.
You list these different, and you explain it so well for someone to understand these different, and I don't know what they called. Are they called precepts? Or are they called these different? You have the Eight Noble Truths. Four noble truths.
The four noble truths, which is essentially
all these different numbers.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot of these numbers, and for someone new, it can be daunting, and it can sound like, oh, this is just like, you know, this is just like catechism.
Right.
But you know, the four noble truths basically explains why your life is unsatisfactory. The Noble Eightfold Path is the guidance.
Okay. Yeah.
Is the guidance for how to correct that. And yeah, that's right. I was talking about the monk in the forest. And what the Buddha was telling this monk is, you cannot change the past. What is done is done. It cannot be undone. But what you did is in the past is why you are here in this present moment. Mm-hmm. That is how you got here right now in this present moment. So what you do right now is going to influence and shape your future. Mm-hmm. So stop living in the past. Stop dreaming about the future. Pay attention to what you do right now, all the time. And that will help ensure a happy and satisfactory future and alleviate whatever stress and pain you have created by what you did in the past.
Mm-hmm. And this ties right into the last section of your book, where you talk about the importance of mindfulness and meditation, and you know, give some guidance on how somebody can start to practice meditation in their own life.
That is a very important part. You mentioned the three-legged stool, because that was mm-hmm. a wonderful metaphor that one of my teachers
I love
provided.
That. Yeah,
and meditation is very important. And going back to the three-legged stool, the three parts is we need to develop virtue. And that's where the precepts come in, because they're guidance of, you know, the first thing you need to do is stop doing nasty things to other people. Stop doing things that are hurting other people, and learn how to cultivate things that are more beneficial. So that's what virtue is about. And then the other one is, concentration. All right. And concentration is, that's the meditation, so that you develop a focus in your mind. And if you haven't noticed, my meditation practice has not been the best that it has been, in the past. And that is reflected by my losing my train of thought. So the meditation part is very, very important, because it helps you focus the mind, the monkey mind that we mentioned earlier,
because
our mind does, it flits from one thing to another, and you cannot develop the third leg of the stool, which is wisdom, unless you can focus your mind on things that are helpful, that matter. So the combination of these, and they all work together, because if you spend too much time like on one, if all I do is I sit around and meditate, well, you know, am I developing any wisdom? You know, am I developing any virtue? If I run around and be like virtuous and this total saint, well, do I have any wisdom? You know, and am I able to concentrate on anything? You know, so they all really work together. So they need to be equally developed. And the meditation is really, really important. As I mentioned in the book, you can meditate and not be Buddhist, but you can't be Buddhist unless you meditate.
I remember you said that. Yeah, yeah.
It's
and
very
I think
important.
People will believe, and I think people will be relieved to hear. I remember you saying in your book that it's okay to start with 5 minutes a day, that's perfectly fine.
Right, because that was a struggle that I had initially when I began. I just became so frustrated, you know, because I thought the goal of meditation was to just completely silence my mind.
Yeah,
and that was maddening. I mean, it was
impossible, I suppose. Yeah,
the chatter going on. You know, it's like a bunch of squirrels running around, you know, and like dashing out in the road, and then boom, a car comes by and squashes you because you're not paying attention, or just like the monkey jumping from tree to tree.
Right.
Or like, you know, the wild horse. And so the idea of meditation is to tame that mind so that you can focus it on thoughts and energy that's, you know, so that you can investigate. So the idea of, yeah, just starting off with 5 minutes, you know, how long can you sit silently and pay attention to your breath without any other thought coming into your mind? And it's probably pretty short. But then the idea is not to get frustrated about the fact that you started thinking. The trick I learned was ask yourself, which is thinking, pause. I go, oh, where did that thought come from? So I'm actually kind of training myself to pay attention to that random thought that came into my mind. But as soon as I do that, the thought is gone. Because I can't pay attention to something that doesn't exist.
It's almost like being able to sit back. I'm not sure if this is a metaphor used with what I said about the movie earlier, but almost being able to sit back and watch what's happening like a movie.
Yes. You become a distracted or not so distract. Maybe that's not the right word, but you become an observer who is not invested, because that's where thinking goes. That's what thinking does. It sucks you into, you know, you start thinking about, you know, where did that thought come? Oh, I remember that person. Oh, they made me so mad. Or, did I do well? Or, oh, I forgot to turn. I forgot to turn in that paper, or I forgot to finish that assignment. I said something to so-and-so. Or are they going to be, see all these? And then you start following these thoughts that go, they go nowhere and they create stress. So the idea is to look at your thoughts not as being part of you, but as an object outside of you, and look at it. Oh, this thought, where did it come from? And like I say, as soon as you do that, it kind of disappears. Okay, I'll go back and focus on my breath again. You know, breathe for a few times, and then boom, another thought comes along. Where'd that come from? Oh, it's gone. Okay. And then, you know, once I learned how to do that, you are able to develop longer periods of where you are doing nothing but focusing on your breath and without any other thought coming in. And then when you start to achieve that kind of level of concentration, because that's what you're trying to achieve, concentration, then you can start to focus on, all right, I've been feeling sorrowful about something. Where is that coming from? Is it related to? And so you begin, you can focus your thinking on more practical, beneficial thoughts that occur in your mind and begin to understand where some of these things come from. A breakthrough that I had with my meditation was, it wasn't that I started chasing a thought, but a thought did arise in me that was very relevant to a emotional situation that I was going through at the time. And I was able to look at it without fear and come to understand, you know, why it was there. And it helped me in my interpersonal relationships with some other people because I understood now, why I was doing things that I wasn't exactly sure why.
It's amazing the connections between Buddhism and things that have been adopted from Buddhism in counseling and psychology today, whether it's mindfulness or other things.
There is considerable, there is considerable overlap. And Thich Nhat Hanh was he was a Vietnamese teacher, and he wrote several books that very much talk about that. His book on love is really quite amazing because he has a couple exercises that he recommends that you do, you know, with your significant other or partner, and to evaluate, the relationship at a deeper level as opposed to a superficial level, and how to communicate with people in a method that isn't confrontational is not the right word, but it's in a way that is you're trying to get at the bottom of something for your own gain, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's a exercise for communicating with others that is equally beneficial, because it's based on the Buddhist teachings that on speech, that when you are speaking with somebody, you want to strive for communications that are beneficial, not just to you, but beneficial to that other person.
Yeah.
If it's only beneficial to you, then you're not treating that person as a human being. You're treating them as an object of gain.
Right.
It's just a way of recognizing, when you are doing these things, and there are many psychological practices that are also that kind of work with that. The part with Buddhism that doesn't have really much to do with psychology is, with the explanation or origin of dysfunction.
Right.
Buddhism is more focused on your dysfunction. And this is kind of I could be wrong on this, and it's kind of a dangerous thing to say, but your dysfunction is largely of your own creation. And that's a tough thing for many people. For me, it was to swallow, because it's so easy to turn into self-blame. But that's going back to that other teaching I was mentioning, don't live in the past. Okay. Because of what you did in the past, and maybe you did something really crappy in the past. All right. The karma's coming, baby, because all karma is consequences, and you never know how and when they're going to show up. So when you do, and you start to experience them, and maybe you don't even know why something bad is happening to you, because, man, you've been doing so good lately, but you just accept it. It's your next choice that's going to make all the difference. Psychology teaches that to a large degree, but I don't have to get into too many I don't have to get into transactional analysis. I don't have to get into any Freudian symbolism. I do not need to get into any, Jungian concepts or anything like that to explain the origin of my discomfort. All I need to know is I played a hand in it, and I'm going to play a hand in its resolution.
Mm-hmm. We're almost at the end of the time, but I wanted to make sure I asked you this question. What do you hope readers will take out of your book?
I hope they'll take a laugh and a chuckle.
Yeah, there's definitely that. I had many laughs and I laughed many times. I loved some of the humor. Yeah.
I hope that they get something useful that they can use. I think that's another thing. What I like about Buddhism is that it is verifiable. There's so much in other religions that you have to, it's all faith, that there's this mystery that you cannot know. And there will be points in following the Buddhist path where you're doing something based on faith, but eventually you get to experience the verification that this teaching or whatever, it really happens. It really works this way. You experience it. And when that happens, that verification, that feeling of yes, I understand now, is really quite not just satisfying, but it's very empowering, because then it propels you to the next step. And I think I used a couple very prurient examples in explaining that process, and in terms of the Noble Eightfold Path when I was talking about right effort and right mindfulness. Mm-hmm. What's the one just before right effort? It is not right livelihood, right action. You know, you begin to realize that there is a right way to do things and there is a benefit to doing them the right way. And, mm-hmm. you begin to understand that the consequences of your actions, when you pay attention to what you're doing, not only tend to improve, but the longevity of those consequences improve as well. I used to be a newspaper reporter, and I was interviewing a judge who also, for a time, conducted lie detector tests.
Oh, wow.
And, our discussion turned to, why do people lie? And he said, based on all the lie detector tests that he'd given, his conclusion was people lie because they think the consequence of lying will be less severe than to tell the truth. Mm. So it's like we tend to trick ourselves right from the start into thinking, at least with lying, that, this isn't going to cause any harm or it'll get me out of trouble now, mm-hmm. kind of thing. Whereas, just telling the truth, yeah, there's going to be a consequence for telling the truth. But usually that consequence is going to be isolated to that moment when you tell the truth. It isn't necessarily going to be something following you.
Yeah, there's so much to discuss in this book, and I could probably talk with you another hour, but we have come to the end. And so I just want to thank you again for coming on our podcast today.
Well, thank you very much for reaching out and inviting me to do this. I hope I wasn't too esoteric or rambling.
No, I don't think, I think our listeners are really going to appreciate what you said today. And for our listeners, if you are interested in reading My Pink Buddha, click on the highlighted title of the book in the description included with this podcast. And join us again next time for Queer Voices of the South on the New Books Network.